This is Current State on WKAR. I'm Emmanuel Berry in for Mark Bayshore. Coming up today on our show, we'll preview the Wharton Center's upcoming season. Also, we'll hear from Sean Mack, a Saginaw-based artist whose weekly comics have made their way onto ESPN's True Hoops blog, as well as Complex Music site. And even though he's working for ESPN, you think he must love sports, a big fan of sports. He says he knows very little. Most of his knowledge comes from Space Jam. So we'll talk with him later. But first, the idea of starting a high school under any circumstances is a daunting one, to say the least. But with schools struggling all across Michigan, the economy still on the rebound, and the constant political maneuvering and education policy, the task of creating a new high school in the Lansing area seems that much more difficult. But these obstacles are not stopping our next guest. They say many leaders of Lutheran congregations here in the region think now is the time to try and get a new high school off the ground. Here to tell us more about the effort is Tracy Backus, the principal of Holt Lutheran School, and Dean Pellett, who is the pastor of St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, where Holt Lutheran School is located. Welcome both to Current State.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Tracy, starting a new high school is no simple task. As we just said, there's all these different issues going on. I would imagine it's difficult as well. How long has this been in the works?
Oh, several years. I would say 10 or more from when we first started saying, gee, someday it would be nice. So, yeah.
10 or more years going on. What's the interest been like?
At first it was very idealistic. Yes, someday we would like to. And as the years wore on, it was more and more specific people, more and more saying, yes, we should do this. Yes, let's go ahead. Let's unite. And so within the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, probably it was much more intense.
Dean and Tracy said there have been attempts before to make this work. Why is now the right time to try and start a high school?
I'd say our area Lutheran congregations are building a better rapport. We see a greater need to work together on issues, all kinds of projects, and that kind of camaraderie and fellowship working together always supports and strengthens the community.
Tracy, you guys did a feasibility study. What did it show?
It showed that it was actually a good time, and anywhere from the projection of student growth, there's supposed to be a baby boom of sorts for us, meaning high school boom, roughly 2015 or so. And so by the time we really get it off the ground and moving, there will be an upswing, particularly in Lansing, for the student numbers. And so we thought it would be a great time to start the program and say, look, we have all these students, try our school.
There are many different high schools and schools trying different programs and different ways to draw in students. What distinguishes a Lutheran education? Why go to a Lutheran school? Tracy, you first.
For me, it very simply is the idea that we can live our faith and teach our children to live that faith and live as part of the community, productive Christian members of society. And so we want them to find a way to apply their faith to all walks of life, whether in the academic world and they decide to be an MD, then it's the MD who lives as a servant who works together in his community, or perhaps it's a police officer or a teacher like me. That would be my goal.
Dean, what about you? Why a Lutheran education?
Well, it goes really back to Martin Luther. His understanding was that God is the one who makes us right with God. It's not something we do or are capable of doing. Therefore, God does it for us. And many people in the world today have the idea that they need to be somehow good enough or work hard at measuring up before God will accept them. And that really changes the dynamic of how you live, whether you're struggling and scraping and fighting or whether you're celebrating in a sense, I've been made right with God and now I can live freely. Very different approach.
What about curriculum? What will the curriculum be like? Will it be the same as what's currently at Holt Lutheran?
Yes, it will be for the most part. And we are an accredited program. We do follow the Michigan Merit Curriculum. We have very high standards. And so I plan on shifting that across as we roll into the new school.
Any plans for athletics or sports teams?
Yes, we already do have sports teams. We are MHSAA Class D school. And so we plan to continue that. My son is hoping we have a football team. We'll see.
So going back a little bit to curriculum, do you guys follow Common Core standards as well?
We do to some degree. We are allowed to take sort of an a la carte approach because we aren't tied into federal funding or state funding. We can pick and choose as we do. And currently, right now, we do for the most part.
What about MEAP testing? I mean, how do you
we
measure
do MEAP
the
tests.
Kids?
Okay. We do utilize MEAP tests, ACT. We are going to do Stanford Achievement Test 2 weeks from now. But the bonus for us is that it's not tied to any funding, so we can use it truly as they were designed to measure our student output and then help them where they need.
Dean, what are your biggest concerns? I mean, what keeps you up at night about this project?
Well, people, as she said earlier, idealistically, it's easy to say we should do this. But once you do it, then you need boots on the ground. You need people involved, committed, time commitment, financial commitment. And, it's easy to say, I'd like to be part of that or I will be part of it. But once, the day comes, does the buck stop here or does the funding come in? Do the people commit their time? Mm-hmm. And that's always a huge variable.
Tracy, what about you? What are your concerns?
It would be the same financial. There will be tuition involved, and each congregation will be able to assist its members and then perhaps non-members as well with sorts of scholarships. But, of course, finances tend to drive the bus in education, unfortunately. So,
what are your goals in terms of student numbers for this new high school?
My hope is that we'll have at least 20. This next year it could be 16 or 17, but that's my goal to start. I would like to see 50, perhaps even 75 by the third or fourth year.
What are the numbers currently like at St. Matthew's, right, or the Holt Lutheran?
Holt Lutheran, we have 98 students altogether, 24 are high school.
Have you guys settled on a name for the high school?
It is Mid-Michigan Lutheran High School, but mascot and colors to be determined.
Mascot and color. What are you guys thinking for a mascot?
Well,
I went to Eastern, so we were Quakers, which was bizarre in itself. So, yeah, what are you guys thinking?
Well, I'm a lion, personally, Detroit.
Okay.
My son is lobbying heavy for some sort of bear, being a Bears fan, and so we'll see.
I think the strangest mascot I've heard is a narwhals for
a
hockey team. The hockey team narwhals. That's a unique, interesting one. No competition. No repeats there. So where will you be looking location-wise for the school? Because this is, it's a kind of large area that you're trying to bring a bunch of congregations together.
It is. Currently, we are in Holt, like I said, but we're thinking perhaps North Lansing or West Lansing? Is that correct?
Something close to the interstate makes it as convenient as it can get for people from farther areas to drive in. Mm-hmm. But near the interstate, property values go up too.
And so are you looking to build something, renovate something?
Right now there's been discussion about finding something existing if possible, but building is not out of the question. Again, we end up at that financial question.
Yeah.
Do we have funds for that, or would it be better to invest in something that's already built and renovated?
I'm curious as to if this school is going to be only for people who are of the Lutheran faith, or is it open to everyone?
Oh, it will be open to everyone. We have several non-Lutherans currently in our high school, in fact, now. So, absolutely.
Currently at St. Matthew's, what's the makeup like of people who are Lutheran versus
at Holt Lutheran?
At Holt Lutheran, yes.
Less than 50% Lutheran right now.
You've mentioned funding issues several times, Dean. What are some of the strategies that you guys are trying to implement to fix those problems?
I don't know if we have really any strategies on that yet. The feasibility study recommended something, I think, like 3 to 8% of outside third source funding is kind of a standard model, and we, that was a learning experience for us. We had thought, oh, maybe it'd be higher than that. So we've realized the majority needs to be internal, i.e. through tuition and through church member support. And so that's going to be part of pulling this off, is educating our area church members about the value of this and getting them on board. And so, we're not ahead of the game on that issue. That's certainly the case.
Tracy, you grew up with a Lutheran education. What do you think it gave you?
It gave me this concept of using my education to try to serve and not just make it about myself. How can I be part of a greater community, and how can I pass that legacy on to others? So, and my son is currently there, as I said before, so I'm there physically trying to do that.
Have you always worked in a Lutheran school, or have you worked in other public schools?
I, for the most part, have worked always at Holt Lutheran, in fact, yes. A very short stint at Holt Public in the child care center, but that was it.
So, Dean, how certain of a reality is this today? I mean, is it far off? Or?
It's going to be starting by this July 1st is kind of the official start date. We have four congregations who've already said, yes, we'll be part of this. We have two more voting in May 4th. And so pretty optimistic at least about one of the two for sure, if not both. And that already is much more support than we currently have doing it on our own. And so it's definitely a go. How much it flourishes and blossoms is kind of the key, but I think it's definitely a go, the association. So now it's just a matter of what's going to happen a year from now.
Yeah.
And then 2 years. And so we'll be evaluating all that, obviously, as we go, week by week, month by month, probably.
Tracy, fall is not far away at this point. What are the next steps, immediate steps for you guys?
Well, setting our faculty, once we have the official go-ahead, assigning classes and teachers and lockers and the specific plans that go into all of that. Sports as well. Again, my son's dream of football is on the horizon. So,
Tracy Backus is the principal of Holt Lutheran School, and Dean Pellett is the pastor of St. Matthew's Lutheran Church. Thank you guys both for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. For many years, the Wharton Center for Performing Arts at MSU has announced its schedule for the coming year with a big story in the Sunday paper. Patrons are especially anxious to know what shows will be in East Lansing next year, and Current State's Scott Pohl is here with the first of two Wharton Center previews. Scott, why is the schedule coming out in two parts this year?
Well, in the past, they've put the schedule out in a big splashy Sunday paper story, and everybody looked forward to that. It was always a little frustrating for us because we had to wait until Monday to talk about it. Well, it's a little different this year. Last night, the Wharton Center had a donor event, and part of the fun for the donors that were there was that they took the wraps off part of next year's schedule. They were kind enough to let me in on the secret recently with a few staff interviews. We'll have the rest of next year's schedule 2 weeks from now. For now, though, we're going to talk about the Broadway series, which gets the most attention. So I started there by talking with marketing director Diane Wilcox about the first Broadway show on next year's schedule, Once.
Yes, we're very excited to open our Broadway season with Once, which actually started out as a film in 2007, very, very well received. And the show itself, the musical, won 8 Tony Awards. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece about an Irish musician and an Eastern European immigrant that he meets and what she brings out in him in terms of his talent and his ability to excel as a musician.
It was a small film. I know it was a big hit on Broadway, but a small film. A lot of people aren't really familiar with anything about Once other than the song Falling Slowly.
That's true. That's very, very true. It became sort of a cult hit, and it was one of those movies that just sort of never disappeared. And the show itself, though, the music came from John Carney, who was the original writer of the film, and they took the story of the film, the love story, the sort of anti-love story that is in the film, and brought it to the stage. And it's absolutely magnificent. It's staged in a very unusual manner, and it features a lot of musicians who then also are actors. They started with musicians as opposed to starting with actors in terms of casting the show. Absolutely magnificent. It toured, it launched in late 2013 in Rhode Island, and this is a really, it's a very successful tour. We're really excited to have it be the first one to open the season.
A Broadway revival that people will be excited to hear is going to be at the Wharton Center. Annie will be here in December.
That's right. We're really, really excited to bring it back. It's one of those shows that our audiences can't seem to get enough of. And it's been a while since it's been here. And so we're talking a whole new generation of both girls and boys to enjoy this show. So we're very excited to bring Annie back.
And lastly, we're going to talk about Kinky Boots, which will be at the Wharton Center next May. Maybe the biggest show that you're bringing to town?
Absolutely. The winner of the Tony Award for the Best Musical last year. This show also, Cyndi Lauper, won the Tony Award for the score. The choreography is Tony Award winning from Jerry Mitchell. And this the story is absolutely magnificent, Kinky Boots, which is the story of a shoe manufacturer that's, at least 100 years old, and they're finding they're hitting hard times. They only manufacture men's shoes. And the way that they revive themselves is by creating special shoes and boots for transvestite performers. And it becomes this great, wonderful, fun, empowering show. It's delightful.
I'm Ryan Clute, Marketing Manager for Wharton Center.
And Ryan, we're going to talk about the dance programming that's coming to Wharton Center. Let's start with the Dance Theater of Harlem. They'll be here in November.
Yes, they are. They will be. Dance Theater of Harlem is a hot, young, reimagined company. They're celebrating over 45 years as a groundbreaking dance ensemble. We're very excited to be presenting them this year. They are they're really known for their physical discipline, and you'll definitely see that on stage live. It's a group of 18 dancers, and they will be performing some of Dance Theater of Harlem's hallmark works.
That's November 12th, and then 3 days later, some of the dancers that people who watch the dancing shows on TV will be familiar with will be here. They're just 3 days apart.
That's right. Pros from Dancing with the Stars and So You Think You Can Dance are coming together on one stage. There will also be international dance champions. They're all competing against each other, and the great thing is the audience gets to pick the winner, which is very exciting. It's topped off with glamorous sets. There's fantastic costumes. There's group numbers. And what's also really exciting as well, it's hosted by Alan Thicke, obviously of Growing Pains fame and songwriting fame.
Robin Thicke's dad.
And also the 10-season Dancing with the Stars pro, Adita Slowinska. So Dancing with the Stars fans will definitely know that name right off the bat.
A busy week for dance fans.
Indeed. Right, just 3 days apart.
I'm Burke Goldstein, director of the MSU Federal Credit Union Institute for Arts and Creativity here at Wharton.
Bert, I want you to tell me about Julian Sands coming to town in a program called A Celebration of Harold Pinter. This is also in November.
Correct. I think one of the real treasures of the Wharton Center is the Paysant Theater. This was a theater that was designed for the spoken word, for classical theater. It was designed after, you know, the Stratford Festival, the Guthrie, those stages that had these great thrust stages. Audiences love being close to the actors. And so in the last couple of years, we've been developing theater in that space. And I don't think there's a greater match for this in the coming season than Julian Sands, this brilliant film and theater actor, coming in to do the poetry of Harold Pinter. This is a piece directed by John Malkovich, and it really honors the spirit of this brilliant, brilliant writer. And we're just very excited for him to come in and do this. I think it'll be a very engaging performance. What's interesting about the performance, it's not just Julian Sands getting up and doing one poem after another. There is a slight story to it. Apparently, Pinter wrote a lot of poems to his wife, and it sort of follows their relationship. So this does have a kind of a storyline to it. And I think it will be just a wonderful evening of theater and the celebration of this brilliant, brilliant writer.
Is this a one-man show?
It is a one-man show, yes. And he does this all over the country. He does it in between his film gigs. And he does about 7 or 8 performances a year, so we're very lucky to be able to get it into the season.
Ryan, next February we have the Hot Sardines. I have to confess I'm not familiar with the Hot Sardines, but I love the name.
They are a great name, and they are. It comes from the French influence of their frontwoman. And Hot Sardines are a phenomenal hot jazz group. They're steeped in sultry stride piano, and they're the kind of music that Louis Armstrong, Django Reinhardt, and Fats Waller used to make. It's straight up foot stomping jazz. It's a lot of fun. They're coming out of the New York hot jazz scene, which is really on fire right now. So it's going to be great. It'll be a roof raising performance, I think.
All right, being Michigan State University's news and classical music station, it's nice to be able to wrap up our segment here today by talking about next April's visit to campus. Itzhak Perlman will be here.
Itzhak Perlman almost needs no introduction. He is really, he's a legend in classical music. He's the reigning virtuoso of the violin. He has a joy for music making that really speaks to audiences. His musicianship, his artistry, it's a delight to watch, to listen to experience, and it's one I'm very excited to hear next year.
Well, that's about half of the Wharton Center schedule for 2014-15. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with the other half. For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Artist Sean Mack said he's been drawing since he was in diapers. Well, all that practice paid off. His work is now being featured on two popular publications, ESPN's True Hoop blog and Complex Music's site. Sean, a Saginaw native, joins me now on the phone. Sean, welcome to Current State.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good, doing good.
All right, so you said you started drawing in diapers, but did you really start drawing in diapers? What was your artistic aspirations as a youngin'?
It felt like it was in diapers. It was that early. I know that at least. But I think ever since I was young, I just wanted to draw. It didn't really matter what it was. Early on, it was. Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles, then it turned into comics and so on. And I just realized that I just wanted to draw, whether it be like illustration or comics itself. I just wanted to draw.
All the time. You were one of those kids doodling in class all the time, right?
Basically. it got me in trouble a lot, but, you know, I feel like it was worth it.
Yeah, I think it's worth it now, looking where you are now. What comics did you like to read, or what comics influenced your drawing style growing up?
The comics I liked to read were primarily Batman and Spider-Man. Spider-Man because he was a nerd, and I was a nerd, so I felt close to his world, aside from the superpowers part. But the comics that influenced me, I would say, it's a good question, actually. Because it's so many. It's really broad. But Marvel Comics, for the most part, as a whole, the way they had their stories, it influenced me because it had a superhero comic feel, but it also was a bit more personal. You know, like it delved into the lives of these characters and showed that they are more than just, you know, superpowered villains and heroes and whatnot.
So you really like kind of that personal connection. Is that something that you try and emulate in your work today?
Yeah. I would say early on when I started making my own comics, they were all like autobiographical comics, you know, dealing with my own life and what I had to deal with during college. So having that personal touch in comics is something that I definitely appreciate. It shows a little more side to the characters and a little bit more of your side if you put it into your work like that.
Did you have any formal art training?
Yeah. I actually went to college, College for Career Studies in Detroit, Michigan, and I majored in illustration.
Has it been a struggle for you to do your art, which you clearly love, and make a living?
Yeah, definitely. It's taken a while. I've had to find a way to be able to do both, like trying to do art and trying to have a sufficient amount of income. It hasn't been easy. I'll admit that. But I think for recently, I think that I kind of have a handle on it.
You figured it out? You broke the code?
I wouldn't say I broke the code. It's a complicated code. It's like Matrix. But I think I'm almost there.
So like you said, you're almost there at this point, in the sense that you've recently started illustrating comics for ESPN's True Hoop blog. What sports knowledge do you bring to a blog about basketball?
I'm sorry, say that again?
You started, what sports knowledge do you bring to this job doing comics for ESPN True Hoops?
Honestly, before, the only sports knowledge that I had was watching Space Jam. And yeah, I didn't really have that much knowledge. I mean, I knew the basis of the certain players that we draw in the comics, like LeBron and you know, I knew that base knowledge, but because with the help of Shay, who writes the comics, I'm learning a little more. Plus, I'm starting to watch ESPN a little more, which is like a brand new world to me because I'm used to watching like Community or something. And you know, it's a new world, and because of the comics, I think I'm learning a little more about it. I guess, like I said.
Is there any athlete that's been challenging for you to draw?
I want to say LeBron. But
what about LeBron is hard?
He's got this hairline. Don't really, know what height to draw it at. It's weird. But LeBron has been the trickiest person to get down. Because I've had to draw him a couple of times, actually.
So LeBron James is a difficult comic.
Yeah.
What is the... How did you come to get this job? I mean, you're not necessarily a big sports fan, but how is it that you ended up writing for this ESPN blog then?
Well, the writer of the comic, Shay Serrano, he actually found me on Twitter, which is weird. He found me on Twitter and saw my work, and first we started working together on MySpace articles. The first job that we did was a article about Kanye West's The College Dropout album, which had an anniversary. He wrote it, and I did illustrations for it. And after that, he came to me and was like, we might be able to do some comics for ESPN and Complex. And Complex, I know about Complex, and mm-hmm. that's dealing with hip-hop, and I'm a fan of hip-hop. But ESPN, I was like, I don't really know what to tell you there. He's like, oh, don't worry, I got you. So because he's the writer of the comics, mm-hmm. he gives me base knowledge of the idea, and, it gives me a chance to research whoever player we're putting in the comic for that week. And it gives me more knowledge of more so what's happening in basketball right now.
So basketball's not exactly your thing. But like you said, you are a fan of hip-hop and Complex. You guys do cover a wide range of topics from, I think his name is Diddy now. I'm not sure what Diddy's going now. We're going to say Diddy. His mission to turn Rick Ross into Biggie. You talk about Kendrick's control verse in your comics. What's been the response to these so far?
Those have been crazy. Like, people have really, they really like them, I should say, yeah. Because so far, I've been reading comments, and people have, there's been a bunch of ha-ha-has and LOL, so I'm guessing people like it, you know. And my friends have you know, told me how it's turning out great. So I think the response has been pretty cool so far.
You also have your own project called The Revolutionary Times, which you co-produce with your friend Brandon Howard.
Yes.
First, can you describe the characters of this book and the basic premise?
Well, the characters are basically, they're based on us. Both names are Brandon and Sean, and you know, they're based on our physical, and I guess personality-wise too. They're based on that. But the basic premise is these two guys who get together and have this newspaper called the Revolutionary Times that talks about, you know, pop culture and political satire, and it goes a little more insane as it goes on. At some point, we forgot all about the newspaper, and it just went from straight satire and pop culture. So that's basically been the ideal of the comic so far, you know, having a go at pop culture, but still having a type of message in the comic itself.
No, you're fine. What's it like to kind of illustrate your life like that?
It's eye-opening, I should say, because I'm not really a sharer, I guess you could say. I don't really share what happens most of the time in my life. So putting it to a comic form, it makes me feel a bit more open than I'm used to. And I think that's more so helpful in my case, because, you know, I'm not a talker. I'm not a social type of dude. So being able to let certain aspects of my life out in an art form that I'm comfortable in and I love, it's kind of enriching.
The comic was on hiatus for a bit. When are you planning to release more work?
This month, we're actually starting to get back on it. The date is for next Tuesday for the new comics to start up. Plus, we finally got a website, and so we finally got all that together. So next Tuesday should be the start date for all that.
You said that it's been a struggle to find your way into making a living and doing your art. Any advice for young aspiring artists?
The one thing that comes to my mind is patience. Like, you definitely have to have patience. You know, the art industry is definitely, it's hard to get into. Like, I've been trying so long, but having patience and being persistent about everything is definitely key. Like, don't keep updating your portfolio. Keep up with your craft. Always learn new things that will help, you know, help better yourself as an artist. But most of all, it's just patience and persistence. Keep applying for jobs. Keep making connections, because you never know what connection is gonna be that breaking point. You know, like, I didn't know my Twitter was gonna help me draw LeBron James in the future. You know?
Right. Sean Mack is a Saginaw-based artist. You can find his work on ESPN's True Hoops blog and Complex Music's website. You can also find more of his work at smackillustrations.com. Sean, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Emmanuel Berry. This is Current State, and I'm in for Mark Bayshore again. The Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra closes its 2013-14 season Saturday night at 8 at the Michigan Theater with an all Brahms program. 90.5 Classical will broadcast the live concert. WKR's Peter Worf spoke with music director R.E.A. Lipsky on Wednesday. The two looked ahead to the upcoming season at the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra and talked about Saturday's concert. Lipsky explained that one of Brahms' works, originally for piano, is arranged by University of Michigan composition professor Bright Sheng.
I'm a little suspicious when somebody orchestrates or changes a wonderful piece of music. So when I heard it, I said, wow, not only it's a wonderful arrangement, but it enhances and enriches what Brahms had in mind. And then you think, oh, I think if Brahms heard it, he said, I wish I did that. And I think Bright did a wonderful job. It captured the essence of the piece, the beauty of the melody, and the a forte is not just playing louder on the piano, but the orchestration just kind of mushroom and embellishes, and it's just a beautiful piece. So I'm so happy we can do that.
Have you performed it before with the Ann Arbor Symphony or with other orchestras?
No, this is my first time. I heard it once on the radio, and I said, "Oh, this is just a beautiful piece." So. And they did a wonderful job, so I'm very pleased.
I'm speaking with Ariel Lipsky, the music director of the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra. We're at intermission here at the Michigan Theater in this All Brahms program coming to you live on WKAR. Let's look forward to the second half, and I almost said the main course of this concert, but there have been a couple of main courses so far. But on the second half, we'll be hearing one single work, the First Symphony by Brahms. Has any other piece sort of been looked at more as a struggle or sort of a wrestling with moving from beginning to end as Brahms' First Symphony in terms of composing the piece?
Yeah, Brahms wrote this symphony for over 20 years. He had sketches, but was reluctant to come out with this word symphony after it was associated with Beethoven and his ninth famous symphony. And he wanted it, in a way, to be perfect. So he experimented with the symphonic genre by writing some serenades and, of course, wonderful chamber music and songs and piano music. But it took him quite a long time, until he was 43, to come up with the First Symphony. And what a beginning that was. In the very opening, you can hear these two opposite lines going in agonizing way against each other, and underneath you have this heartbeat played by the timpani and the double basses and the contrabassoon, relentless. It is so powerful, and it just leaves you in awe. And then as you go through the whole symphony, then you arrive in the finale, and this, what a theme, the main theme of the last movement, which is obviously an homage to Beethoven and to the Ode to Joy, and just before that the discussion between the horns, this Alpine horn discussion, which actually was written a couple of years before as a birthday song to
really?
Clara
oh,
Schumann. Yeah, ti-ti-rom-pom. Thank you. Yeah, so, you know, it really encompasses what Brahms is all about, this symphony. You know, Brahms was criticized for perhaps not being like Beethoven or Wagner, because, you know, as we know, Beethoven and Wagner really created a new form of music. They experimented with the future. And Brahms went to the past.
Yeah, he was very traditional.
Yes. He was a master of the Baroque, of even Renaissance music, and the classical music, and brought them to the Romantic era. Mm-hmm. And in that way, he was very different. So it took people some time to really appreciate it. But, oh God, and, you know, all four symphonies that he created, some of the most heroic and beautiful symphonies of the late 19th century.
The first symphony, in many ways, is a traditional piece of music, as you've said, and has many, many others before, following in the steps of Beethoven. But in what other ways is the first symphony uniquely Brahms?
Well, his way, for instance, of arranging the counterpoint is so unique. He took Beethoven's genius of creating a movement out of three or four notes and took it to the nth degree. And then and you can hear it in the first movement, like taking these three notes and creating a whole movement out of it. And it's so ingenious. His imagination is unbelievable.
He does introduce some surprises in the end of the slow movement. All of a sudden, it's almost like the slow movement of a violin concerto, and it's absolutely delightful.
Yes, the inner two movements of the symphonies are a complete departure of this huge, massive movements in the first and the last, which are also orchestrated in a very lush way. They're kind of a, you know, the intermezzo, almost chamber music within the symphony. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the gorgeous violin solo in the end of the first movement, the second movement, the slow movement is absolutely haunting. And I'm really looking forward to our concertmaster, Aaron Borofsky. The way he played it in the rehearsal is just fantastic. So looking forward to hear it joining the audience.
I'm also looking forward to the 2014-15 season, which you've just announced. And as you've done in past seasons, you have some very wonderful thematic programming happening, from an all Beethoven opening concert with one of the great pianists of our time, Andre Watts, Leonore Overture No. 3, Beethoven's 5th, and the Piano Concerto No. 5, the Emperor Concerto. Who wouldn't be thrilled with hearing or presenting a program like that?
Just as I look in the season, I think that No. 5 is a big thematic idea here, as we do the Symphony No. 5 by Beethoven, the Emperor Concerto No. 5, and we finish the season with Mahler 5.
Thank you.
have a wonderful program here in October with Chichester Psalms by Bernstein, and we have a collaboration with the Boy Choir of Ann Arbor, the Vocal Arts Ensemble, and Steve Lorenz Choir. Michael Doherty, who is, again, a world-known composer who lives right here in Michigan, in Ann Arbor, and teaches here at the university, will play his Route 66 and Barber Violin Concerto and Gershwin American in Paris. In November, we bring back another former Ann Arborite, Anton Nell, who used to be on the faculty here, a wonderful pianist, and he'll join us for the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. In March, we again invite the choirs of Huron and Pioneer and Skyline to join us for the Polovtsian dances. The rendition with chorus, which is always so much fun. Shostakovich number 10 and Tchaikovsky Romeo and Juliet.
I'm so excited to hear this all-Russian program coming up in March of 2015, because I have to tell you that Shostakovich's 10th Symphony, as with many classical music listeners, is one of my absolute favorite symphonies of all time. You know, I think representing some of the greatest musical and personal struggle and triumph. I can't wait to hear this piece.
Yes, and it's quite a tour de force for the orchestra.
Yeah, I would say so.
Going to be my first time conducting the symphony, so I'm really looking forward to that. And of course, in January we always celebrate Mozart in his birthday bash concert. We are going to feature our principal oboist, Tim Mischling, fantastic oboe player. He's going to play the oboe concerto, and we're bringing a very fine coloratura soprano to sing some of Mozart's works for that that specific voice. So she'll be singing arias from the Abduction, from the Seraglio, from the Great Mass. And then we'll finish, of course, with one of Mozart's favorite symphonies, my favorite symphonies, Symphony No. 40 in G minor. Looking forward to a great celebration of music next season.
That's a quick look at the 2014-15 season of the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra. Aria Lipsky, music director of the Ann Arbor Symphony Orchestra. Aria, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This Saturday night at 8, WKAR will broadcast the Ann Arbor Symphony season finale live on 90.5 Classical with an encore broadcast Saturday the 19th at noon. That's our show for today. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll break down East Lansing City budget proposal. Also, we'll be back with live music next Friday. The DeCamp Sisters will pay a visit to Studio S. That and more next week on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, also Aaron Young for engineering, and Libby Lessenhop for production assistance. I'm Emmanuel Berry, in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. Thank you.